It's time for Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. This is a weekly podcast featuring Adam Awson, a writer for the weekly publication Current in Carmel. You can read Adam at currentincarmel.com. My name is Larry Lannon. I write a local news blog from Fishers, Indiana, larryinfishers.com. This week, Adam and I review the film Murder on the Orient Express. Our guest is Evan Lurie, a man who currently owns an art gallery in downtown Carmel, but has many stories to tell about his days in Hollywood. Let's get started. Once again, from Donatello's Italian Restaurant, 9 West Main Street in downtown Carmel, once again, welcome to Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. Adam Awson is here once again. Good to see you, Adam.
Good to see you, Larry.
And we're going to have plenty to talk about today. Our showpiece film is going to be Murder on the Orient Express, and Adam's got a couple of other films he's seen this week he'd like to comment on. So let's start off with Murder on the Orient Express. Needless to say, it's not the first time this story has been told on film. It's just a very lavish trip through Europe. It unfolds into a race against time. There's a murder aboard the train when the train is basically stopped and can't move for technical reasons because of an avalanche. It just gets off the tracks, the train does. So the world's greatest detective, at least according to late Agatha Christie, is Hercule Poirot. And he is there on the train, and he interrogates all the passengers, searching for clues before that killer can strike one more time. The director of the film is Kenneth Branagh, and he is also the leading actor in the leading role of Hercule Poirot. And I have a lot to say about that mustache later, but that's a big part of it. But this is an all-star cast, a screenplay by Michael Green. It's based on the novel by Agatha Christie, but as you probably know, some filmmakers have taken license with that. They've changed the ending from the original book that was written many years ago. We're talking about people acting like Penelope Cruz, Willem Dafoe, Judi Dench, Johnny Depp, Michelle Pfeiffer, on and on. Just some outstanding acting talent in this film. So one thing I will say about Murder on the Orient Express before I turn it over to you and we get to the actual film itself, I was very impressed with how much money the studio spent on the cinematography. They use very high-quality film in this. There are some really amazing scenes as they're going around. You see the mountains, you see the train. That much of the film certainly was impressive, but let me ask you to give your thoughts on the film generally.
Overall, I'll start off by saying this isn't a bad film, but it's also not an amazing film. So I'm going to give it, not to spoil the grade, but it's going to be somewhere in the C-ish range, maybe a little below or above, kind of depending on your thoughts. But you have a Shakespearean actor of Kenneth Branagh, who's known for a lot of dramatic pieces. He's moved into some big picture work. He's directed a lot of films over the years, but kind of shifting a bit when he did the first Thor movie. And he's always been a little bit better at coaching up the actors than he is with camera movement. I thought the cinematography was great in here. I did like the way the mountain roared through the scenes, but I felt like he almost was trying to flex that muscle a little too much and trying to have the camera pan across the windows of the train to show a double image. There was a lot of work there to try to show that he knew what he was doing behind the camera. And it wasn't bad, but it was almost, I noticed it too much, which is never a good thing. I will say that I don't think he's the best cast as Hercule Poirot. He gives a great performance, a very natural, subtle performance. But I almost would have preferred a larger-than-life performance because this is the world's greatest detective. I think him giving more of a realistic, subtle performance made the film a little less fun. And dare I say it, I would have liked a little more overacting. I know that sounds crazy in a movie.
Well, Johnny Depp did some of that.
Johnny Depp did a little bit of that too, but I felt like every actor in this film was spot on with their performance, but their performance wasn't meaty enough for Oscar-worthy prestige film, but it wasn't fun enough for a pulpy you know, comic book, popcorn movie. So it's stuck in this no man's land, kind of in between these two categories. So not a great film, not a bad film, but really the real mystery of this film for me was, who were they making this film for? It felt like it really needed to find its identity. A lot of people have noted in the reviews, and I've been trying to do the Larry thing of looking for the reviews after I see the movie, but a lot of the people on Rotten Tomatoes, and this is getting a below 50% score right now. I don't think it's that bad, but they're saying that it wastes a very talented cast, and there's some truth to that. The way the screenplay paces, you don't get a lot of screen time for Judi Dench, or, you know who I thought did a really good job was Josh Gad, who we saw in Marshall. He did a good job. You have Leslie Odom Jr., who won a Tony for Hamilton and now is kind of breaking into the film industry. And then Daisy Ridley, you know, from Star Wars Force Awakens, she has a good performance. But they all get small parts. No one gets a lot of time. Willem Dafoe seemed really wasted to me, and we just saw how fantastic he can be in The Florida Project earlier this year. Problem with that is I think they took too long to get onto the train and look with the murder. They had to show kind of this prologue mystery, and that was meant to establish Perot as a great detective that I felt was kind of needless. They take time for him to get on the train and for everything to happen. Then they take time before the actual murder occurs. By the time you get into the mystery, it feels like we're rushing through the best part of the film, which is the whodunit part. So I would have changed a few things there with the pacing. Overall, to use kind of the train metaphor, I'll say, you know, the film never derails, but it never really chugs along and picks up steam. It's kind of just going at a leisurely pace. And really, I didn't get too excited in the film until the ending. Mm-hmm. I won't spoil it, but I feel they made the right choice with the ending, if you're familiar with the past movie and with the book, the source material. And the ending's pretty exciting and well done. And so that's not a disappointment. Overall, not a bad film, but could use some improvement.
I think the key, I agree with you almost wholeheartedly in the way that you have analyzed this film. I would give it a C as well. It's not a bad film. It does many things well. Here's the problem with it as far as giving it a higher grade. It's the story. It's the way the story moves along. You're almost in this. They're in this train that when they start off, it was at Turkey or the Middle East. Mm-hmm. They go from there. They get on the train, and there's all kinds of little subplots getting on the train. On the train, people are on the train. You're getting your characters all revealed. It's like, okay, you're almost like, will the murder please happen so we can move on? Who's going to get murdered? You have an idea, and that sort of unfortunately gets foreshadowed almost a little too much as to who is going to be the murder victim. Well, then, of course, the usual suspects are all looked at and questioned, and all the facts are here, and then, of course, they lead you one direction, and it goes to another. So some of these things, I'm not saying it was all done badly. I think the story unfolded in a way where the audience just doesn't really get sucked into it. I didn't get sucked into it. My wife liked it a lot better than I did, but I have to say, I think it depends on the type of a person who's watching the film. I think the average movie audience will look at that cast and say, wow, just what you said. What a waste. I mean, it's a great ensemble cast. Couldn't they have been more of an ensemble? Couldn't they have done a better job? And here's another thing that always strikes me. Anytime I see a film, even if it's a great talent like Kenneth Branagh, if you see a film where the star in the movie is also the director, that's usually a foreshadowing of a problem, because it's very hard as director to keep an eye on everything and also be the lead character and carry the load of being in almost every scene, which he was. Can I talk about the mustache yet?
Yeah, I think the mustache got more screen time than some of the actors.
Because I saw something, I think it was in USA Today today. I think it was in today's paper about Kenneth Branagh gave a whole interview just on the mustache. About is it too much, or is it not enough, or is it right? And he said he kept asking people, and that's why he ended up doing the mustache precisely the way he did it. I'm not sure that there is a precise way to do it. I mean, that part didn't bother me, but they spent a whole lot of time talking about that. So I would say it's a C film. If it's not the best murder mystery by any means, I will say this. the Agatha Christie family did consult on this film. They were a part of this. So they had a hand in it, but that doesn't mean that they should be blamed if it's not a good film, because there are a lot of ingredients that go into whether a film was good or not. And I'm not sure the individual actors had any problem. I think it's just the way that it all came together in the end, of the way the story was unfolding before us. I mean, it started off as a really interesting film. There were two or three little plot twists, what Poirot was doing. And then he gets on the train, and really, unfortunately, that's when the story kind of falls apart. But the ending is very strong. I will agree with that.
I have to laugh, though. If you saw the trailer for this film, the marketing tries to make the film seem very hip and cool.
It's
so
not.
They put Imagine Dragons, a very popular band nowadays, and they have the pain, you know, that kind of today's music playing there.
Yeah.
So in the crowd, when I saw it, there was a lot of millennial-aged couples. And it was, I think it did better than expected in the box office. Maybe it was a good date movie for people. They saw, oh, I love Johnny Depp. Well,
he didn't last long.
No, I hate to say it.
Like, I hate to say it. That's no big surprise.
Yeah, but I think the film kind of did have a target demographic. I think the people who went to saw it, I don't know if they ended up disappointed or not. I imagine so, because the film's not very hip. It still has a lot of that old-fashioned sensibility, which is fine, but it kind of was marketed a little differently. I think the film could have been a lot more fun. Maybe it could have a lot more levity, maybe some more humor. There was some humor in the film, but it could use more. And, you know, I said he was miscast. Larry, I had a great idea, so I was trying to think who should have played Hercule Poirot instead of Kenneth Branagh.
Who would that person be?
Ralph Fiennes.
Oh.
What do you think?
That's an idea. Yeah.
He can do humor. Remember Grand Budapest Hotel?
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
I think he would have been pretty good.
Well, unfortunately, the casting directors aren't listening to you. Although sometimes people wonder, is it the casting director or the director his or herself that's really casting the film? But no, that would have been but you know, if you're going to be the director, you decide who your actors are going to be. And if you want to be the main character, you can be the main character. I think you pay a price for that. There are people who have done it well. Clint Eastwood, for instance, has directed films he's been in and has done a very good job. But I just think it's hard to do. Makes it an extra level of difficulty in getting that film done well. So, well, yeah, I guess we both come down as a C. My wife liked it better than I did. So if you're listening, you know, take that into consideration. She has high standards.
And just to mark a C grade, a lot of people say, oh my God, that's terrible. I'm not going to go see it. Well, if you only go see a few movies a year, maybe it's not worth it to you. If you go to the movies twice a month, maybe this is worth it. If you're going to go plan on seeing something and you're looking at what's coming out, you think this could be a better option than a lot of films out there. And a C grade also means, hey, if you're at the Redbox later or you're watching something on cable and you need something to watch, you could do a lot worse than this movie. It's enjoyable.
Yeah, and when I give a film a C, it's not a bad film. It's just not something I'd run out and see right away. If I have a chance to see it in whatever form, at the movie theater or streaming or pay channel or however you decide you want to watch film, or Redbox, however you do that. So I think that, keep in mind that C means nothing wrong with it, just not great. All right, well, I understand you've been busy at the film. I've been busy traveling the state doing some instructing, so you've had a chance to see some more films. I really am interested in to hear what you've seen and what you think about them.
Saw two movies that was really excited for. I saw them both at the Landmark Keystone Arts Theater, which is really, this time of year with kind of the Oscars coming up, will be probably my key theater. And although some of those Oscar movies will go to the main theaters like Flix and Regal and AMC too. But I saw, first off, The Killing of a Sacred Deer. And I was looking forward to this. This is by, and I know this is kind of difficult saying name, Yorgos Lanthimos. He's a Greek director.
Good try. I don't know how it's pronounced either.
Yeah, he did Dogtooth, and then he did The Lobster. And me and my wife both really liked The Lobster, his previous film, which was a very dark comedy starring Colin Farrell. And I think Rachel Weisz had a supporting role there. I didn't get a lot of awards nominations last time. I think I got maybe a screenplay and some Golden Globes. But it had a lot of things to say, and I thought it was very interesting. This one was billed as more of a Kubrick-esque thriller. Maybe not scary, but more creepy. And I don't want to give away the plot too much because spoiler, but basically there's this surgeon played by Colin Farrell, and this young boy is showing up and kind of almost stalking the family, and you don't really know his motivation. And then one of the family members in Colin Farrell's family starts to suddenly get paralyzed from the legs down, and it's a medical mystery, and no one knows why it's happening. And I'll stop there because it really develops. The story is interesting. If you need every little bit explained to you when you leave the theater, you will be disappointed because there are some things by the end of the film that will not be explained. It makes some interesting choices. It is an uncomfortable film. Mm-hmm. At the end, I think me and my wife decided that the only way to really make sense of the movie were to say it was all a nightmare in Colin Farrell's mind. If that were the case, then some of the weird dialogue would make more sense. Some of the characters don't talk like normal humans. They say some kind of weird, uncomfortable things that, like, they didn't have a filter. So the screenplay was kind of odd. Don't take your grandma to see this one. It gets pretty out there. It gets violent. It gets sexual, and it gets shocking.
So, what's your grade?
You know what? None of those things are a detractor for me. Just because a film is out there shocking doesn't. As long as it has something to say, I don't know if this film had anything to say.
Okay.
And at the end, I was somewhat disappointed. I gave it 3 out of 5 stars. So maybe it's a C+, B-, and more of a C+, because I was disappointed, but it's not a terrible film.
But it's edgy and test boundaries. Is that
some
what
people
saying?
Are going to love it, but yeah. I think 1% of the audiences out there are going to love it.
Okay. Sure.
I also saw a advanced screening of 3 Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. And now this film comes out Tuesday. At the Keystone Arts Theater, so a little sneak preview there. It's by Martin McDonagh, the director of In Bruges and 7 Psychopaths. I've seen both of those, both dark comedies. In Bruges is another fantastic film, also starring Colin Farrell. This time he does another dark comedy, and it is a comedy. There are a lot of parts that make you really laugh in this film, but it gets really dark too. This one maybe not as uncomfortable because it's not as sexual or as disturbing, but it's very violent. Sorry if you can hear the rain in the background.
Yeah,
it's pouring.
As we record this, the rain's pouring down. You could probably hear it.
I kind of like the sound of it. It's kind of cool.
Well, it could be snowing, so we can think of it that way.
That's true.
Go ahead.
This film stars Frances McDormand, who plays a woman who saw her daughter tragically murdered. And they have not found the killer. And she's in a small town in Missouri, out Ebbing, Missouri. And so her action, in order to kind of maybe spur the police into finally finding the killer, is to buy 3 billboards. And the billboards, I don't want to give away what they say, but basically they blame Police Chief Willoughby, played by Woody Harrelson, for not finding the murderer. And Sam Rockwell plays his deputy, who is kind of racist, has an anger problem, who kind of is rash to making poor decisions. Great cast. I could expect a nomination definitely for Frances McDormand and possibly for Harrelson and Rockwell as supporting actors. But definitely McDormand, I would bet money that she will get an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. It is her best performance since Fargo. Mm.
You know, I was looking at the trailers for that and some of the TV ads. And it's very clear they've made her up to look like something different than her previous characters in film. Would you say that's true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she is a spitfire. She is a fighter who is trying to do something with her loss and anger. Really, the message of this movie is you have, similar to last year's Manchester by the Sea, where you had characters, and by the way, Lucas Hedges from that film is in this film too. You have characters who are dealing with loss and grief. But in this film, they have anger because of it. And that anger leads them to actions which cause other people to be angry and begets more anger. And it's almost like pouring gasoline on a fire, and it builds until it's an inferno. And the whole film takes you into some unexpected places. It wasn't predictable in its plot. And the ending, although some people might not like it, I loved.
Okay.
I thought the ending was not your typical Hollywood ending, and I really appreciated it. I gave this film 4.5 stars.
Oh, okay. So you think it's on the Oscar buzz.
It could be in the top 5 or 10 movies of the year for me.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it's still early, but it was pretty amazing. It will offend some. I will say, because I saw the screening, there were a lot of people talking. I think they just got some free passes, but you know, usually you deal with one person talking in the theater. Larry, on my left, on my right, in front of me, behind me. And I have a hard time when people are talking because of my hearing. I start to like turn my head all the time. Yeah. I had to really focus so I didn't get distracted by that. But
it's awfully annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I'll just pay next time. I liked going to film early. That was fun, but it was a little distracting.
I was going to give you a little news item here before we go on to our next segment. The buzz is already building for Star Wars. Star Wars opens, I think, December 15th in most theaters. I just found out something. I think it was in the New York Times, but they're quoting The Hollywood Reporter. Actually, there's a TV show that The Hollywood Reporter produces. It's kind of an actor's roundtable. I can't remember which Sundance channel or one of those channels, IFC, is where they produce that. In that television recording session, it was confirmed that there will be genuine royalty in the Star Wars film. That's right. The two... Prince William and Prince Harry will both be in the Star Wars film. Now, they don't have huge parts. We really don't know if they're even going to have a speaking part, but they're like in an elevator or something like that with someone, and they have some kind of a fight, and they're in. So it's going to be some gaffing or some stunt work or choreography done there. So that's something I just came across.
Now, you said that the Star Wars opening night is great timing for you. You kind of wrap up some of your...
My wife is retiring after many years of working for her company, and her last day is scheduled to be December 14th, and also December 14th is the last day. And I'll be teaching a class in Fishers after traveling the state of my hometown. So that'll be my last class on December 14th. So my wife and I plan on doing some celebrating the next day. We are at least tentatively hoping to see the Star Wars film on the 15th.
Now, are you going to dress up for the premiere? Come on, Larry.
No.
I can see you as a pretty good Obi-Wan.
You want me to dress up as Obi-Wan?
Yes. Obi-Wan's cool.
Well, that wouldn't be too hard a costume to figure out.
Darth Maul. I need you to put the full makeup on. Darth Maul.
I had a fellow I worked with in radio years ago, and he was a huge Star Wars fan after the first film came out. And he loved to dress up like Darth Vader or one of those stormtrooper types. He had a whole wardrobe and stuff like that.
I love looking every year for Halloween at little kids during when Star Wars comes out. Now we get to see them again. Little kids dressed up in Star Wars costumes always warms your heart, and especially dogs dressed up as either Ewoks or Chewbacca or Han Solo.
I'm not sure the dogs like it very much, but the people enjoy seeing.
Yeah, my dog does not like wearing clothes ever. So, but you know, I guess some dogs like it. I don't know. But yeah,
I haven't seen one yet, but they may exist.
Yeah. You know, the great thing about Star Wars, and I noticed this 2 years ago with Force Awakens, when you went to the theater, you saw parents, their kids, and even the grandparents all having fond memories of this movie, and they were all together. It really, and it's not like the parents are forcing it upon their kids to make them like Star Wars. They love it. They got the cartoons out. They like rewatching the movies. And seeing this little girl dressed up, and she wasn't dressed up as Princess Leia. She was dressed up as Rey. And I think and she had a lightsaber in her hand. And I thought, you know what? How cool is it nowadays when we try to tell young girls that they can do anything, that you don't have to be the damsel in distress that we saw in films 30, 40 years ago. You can be the hero, and you can have a lightsaber too, and you can help save the day. And I don't know. I just it is kind of heartwarming to see, you know, parents bond with their kids over movies. I mean, that's what movies can do when they're great. They can bring people together, and maybe years from now that young girl will have fond memories of going to the film with their family, and that's the power of cinema.
I mean, there are certain phrases that never die. Play it again, Sam, you know, from Casablanca. There are just a whole list of those. And I think that film does impact us in many other ways, especially the really great films that are well-written and well-acted, well-directed. Those are the films that make an impact on all of us. Star Wars is a concept that has impacted all of us. I mean, I remember seeing it as a young man in my 20s. I took my young brothers, a lot younger than I am, and a couple of my cousins, and had no idea that it was the beginning of a whole odyssey for all of us, because they're all fans now.
And I remember reading a story about Force Awakens about, and this was kind of, it was a column someone wrote about how he had a hard time talking to his dad, and him and his father didn't get along very well, and his dad was a man of few words. His dad was kind of a war vet who just wasn't very close to his kids, but Star Wars was something they had in common. And when they went to the movie together, when the new one came out, it was kind of a touching moment for this father and son to spend that time together. And so stuff like that really does warm your heart.
We've had some great guests on this show, but I think you're really going to enjoy our guest today. Evan Laurie is our guest, and I do want to just do a cautionary note here. Evan has worked on a number of films. He drops a lot of names in this interview, but he also drops a few other words. So be cautioned that normally we like to keep this podcast and all my podcasts I produce G-rated. This one isn't, so there's going to be a little language, but it all fits what he's trying to say. So just don't be offended. If you don't want to hear those words, just stop right now.
I think there's maybe one F-bomb and then a few S-bombs, but he's not getting lewd or anything.
No, it fits the story, and he's not doing it for shock effect. He's just trying to tell a story. So, but if it offends you, you can stop right here and listen next week. Or if you're curious, please stay on and listen, because I think you'll. If that's not going to bother you, I think you're going to really enjoy our interview with Evan Laurie today.
And that bothers you, don't go see Three Billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri. There are quite a few, and not just F-bombs. There's some pretty out-there language in that film.
Well, it's a film we're going to be reviewing in the coming weeks where people actually do that with sign language, but we'll wait on that one. So, and we've already had a screening of that. Okay, we're ready to move on. You're listening to Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. Our podcast originates each week from Donatello's Italian Restaurant, 9 West Main Street in downtown Carmel. Check out the menu at donatellositalian.com. And when you come for dinner, ask about Adam's gelato creation that night. If you enjoy this podcast, Adam and I encourage you to spread the word. Send out links on social media. Our podcast is also available on iTunes. Just search the term Hamilton County Goes to the Movies on iTunes. Now, on to this week's guest.
Our guest today is Evan Laurie, the owner of Evan Laurie Gallery, right across the street from Donatello's Italian Restaurant. I see him quite a lot because he has his favorite dishes here. In fact, when we see the caller ID, we say, okay, Evan, you need some penne with marinara and chicken or spaghetti bolognese.
Well, that sounds good.
He is a creature of habit.
I am. Very predictable.
And then I learned that Evan, in addition to being a big figure in the art world, has a lot of experience in Hollywood movies, too. And so I thought, what a kind of perfect tie-in to bring in a Carmel business owner here to talk about some of the movie experience. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So tell us, I want to go from the beginning. How did you get into acting and being involved in movies? How did that start for you?
Completely by accident, really. I grew up most of my life in Europe, and I spent a great deal of my childhood doing martial arts. My mom always made sure I was in these little karate schools all over Europe where we lived, and kind of became my go-to thing. My whole life was around martial arts. And when I moved back to the States, I had a little school in Manhattan. And one of my roommates, I was bouncing actually at a nightclub, and one of my roommates was a bartender there, and he ended up going out to L.A. and getting cast on 21 Jump Street. And his name was Richard Grieco. And so, yeah. So Richard calls me up. He's like, dude, you got to come out here. You got to check it out. You know, a guy like you, you might do well out here. So I didn't really think much about it. And I get a phone call at my dojo from Jean-Claude Van Damme, who happens to know, the circles that Richard's moving in now. And he said, come on out to L.A. Let's check you out, man. So I went out to L.A., ended up meeting Van Damme and hanging out with him, and he hired me to be his trainer. And he said, you want to go to Hong Kong? And I said, what for? And he said, well, you can be the bad guy, one of the bad guys in this movie, and you can also choreograph all the fights for me. So I said, I think I can do that. So I went back to New York, packed up all my shit, went out to California, made home out there, and a week after I got back, I was on a flight to Hong Kong.
Now, what film was that?
Double Impact.
So that was the film where he played two different characters.
Yes, Double the Venn Damage.
I love those 80s, 90s lines that would have the posters of the box.
Yeah, it wasn't enough we had to deal with one of them. There was two of them. And one was so gay. But we didn't tell him that because we all worked for him, so we just kind of went
along. The character only, right?
The character, but the clothing was just pitiful.
The clothing, too.
But it was, you know, it was the early 90s.
Now, you've worked with some big names. Tell us about some of them.
Well, you know, I was fortunate enough when we went to Hong Kong, we used all of Jackie Chan's stunt guys. The company that we used over there to do the production stuff there was Shaw Brothers Studios, which is owned by Jackie. And so we had all his fighters as, you know, parts in our movie. And so Jackie would come over a lot and, you know, hung out on the set with us and had us to his home. And also a guy named Bolo Yoon. Now, Bolo is a very famous martial artist, but more well-known in Asia. But he was also in Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee. So he's been around for a while. So, you know, getting to know all these people over there when the film production was over, they said, don't go home. Stay here and work with us. So I ended up staying in Hong Kong for a while and did several films with Jackie and Jet Li, who at that time was a nobody. From there, went back to the States and kind of came back with a bit of a name in that genre of film. So I went to some of the film festivals and was picked up by other productions and kind of segued from one film to the other. So for a number of years, I just kind of bounced from one movie to another. Lots of martial arts movies, American Kickboxer, Hologram Man, T-Force, just, you know, all kinds of crazy, you know, B-movies, but they're fun. You know, always like those late, they're like these late night movies. You know, I have friends that will call me up drunk at like 4 a.m. Hey, you're on TV! Some obscure channel that nobody knows. You know?
I always miss the drive-in theaters. Those were the second features when the old drive-ins were popular. Now they're at 4 a.m. on a pay channel.
And nobody
streaming knows.
You know, with subtitles and, you know, that's when people see me these days. So, but, you know, through doing the martial arts things, I met an amazing man, a guy and his brother, actually, that from Double Impact, they were the stunt coordinators and second unit directors, which are the guys that put all the action together. And his name was Vic and Andy Armstrong, two British brothers that had the best stunt team, I think, in the business at the time. They were doing all the Bond movies. They had a big contract with the name of the production company in London, but they did all of their productions for them. So I went over there and trained at their camp, and then really started finding I loved doing stunts more than, you know, being an actor. I wasn't a very good actor, I'll just put it that way. So stunts seemed to be more my gig. So they kept throwing me into cars and asking me to flip them and crash them and flip buses and jump off buildings. And I was like, okay, I can kind of do this and nobody's going to criticize my acting. And it's more fun than, you know, kind of an adrenaline rush.
Did you ever have any stunts that went wrong?
Oh, I've had a few,
Well, I'm curious, how much does Hollywood pay to the safety for stuntmen? I've heard a lot of stories about this. Do they really put safety features in there, or are you a lot at risk when you're doing these stunts?
No, we you know, these things are rehearsed, you know, over and over. We have protective roll cages that are built specially in vehicles that we're going to destroy if we're in them. But, you know, things happen. You know, people push the envelope. Every director wants to see something newer, bigger, crazier. And I spent quite a number of years off and on in the hospital. One time, I had a piece of steel went in me, threw me up, 600 stitches, tore me up, pretty big, you know, big accidents, big recoveries. One time I couldn't work for a year, 12 reconstructive surgeries, put me back together again.
Yeah. I have heard that it's a special talent for stunt people to be able to drive a car and do that kind of stunt work. Did you do that? If so, what was it like?
Stunt driving?
Stunt driving, I guess.
Well, yeah. I went to these people's camp in England, and they taught this special, you know, how to flip a car and how to do, you know, how to maneuver cars to be flipped and crashing cars the best way. So, you know, I learned a lot from being around these guys and then doing it. And, you know, and each time you do something, you go, okay, next time I'll do it a little more. And the next time I'll do it a little more. Next thing you know, everybody's saying, you need to chill out a little bit. You're going a little. Perhaps you should think about stepping back, getting a little old for this one.
So, now, some of the special effects back in the day, they had to be a little more creative because they didn't have the computer effects that they have nowadays.
Well, no, no. And you know what? Stunts, you see a lot more CGI now involved with a stunt. Like, they can add, you know, so much more into the actual frame. Fire, things like that. So you're seeing a lot of what you're seeing now, the optics are completely different. Everything we did before was real time. You know, now so much of it is fixed after the fact and post.
I overheard you were telling a story about a film you worked on where it was kind of interesting. It was called Cyborg, and they had to use amputees to play. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was Cyborg 3. I play the sheriff of a misfit cyborg town, basically. The rejects. Yeah, I was the sheriff of the land of rejects. It was an amazing film. That was the film that I just met some guys that just blew my mind. As a person who rides motorcycles, you know, you always meet somebody that will tell you along the way, oh, I lost my leg on a bike, never get on one again. And you go, oh boy, okay. You get on your bike the next time and you're like extra, extra careful, you know? So, you know, I kind of went through things like that until I started working on this film. And they had to hire all these actors that were missing different arms and legs.
Because the robots were missing.
Right, because there were all these robots that had missing limbs, you know. So they found a lot of actors. There's a lot of phenomenal actors out there that have, you know, the issues. And we're sitting having lunch, and I said to these guys, I said, so what happened? How did all you guys... And I tell you, 4 out of every 5 was a motorcycle accident. Mm. And they all wanted to talk about it because it was like good therapy. Mm. But all those guys that still had motorcycles were all looking at each other like, I'm selling my bike. I'm never going to get on. You know, you meet so many guys. Well, there was one story about this one guy that I thought was fascinating. He was a Broadway actor, danced and everything, just kind of this larger-than-life kind of guy. But he was an alcoholic, and he did a performance one night, and he was on his way home, and he got drunk, and he went down to take the subway back to his house, and he was drunk, and he was leaning against the wall, and the train came, and he lost his footing and fell into the tracks, and the train ran him over and severed his legs just below his waist, completely off, but also sealed it. The train was so heavy that it, you know, amputated and cauterized both legs. And he was trapped. He couldn't, you know, for like 8 hours, they couldn't move the train because they thought they were going to kill him. So he lived through this. Hmm. And he's in, obviously, a wheelchair.
That should have been a movie. That sounds like...
some crazy shit happens to people, you know. I also stopped drinking and sold my motorcycle at that time. and I don't take the subway anymore. But yeah, he was a phenomenal guy. And, you know, for somebody like him, getting acting roles was tough, even though he's an incredibly seasoned actor. So this was an opportunity for him to show his stuff as an actor, and he did phenomenally, you know. But yeah, that's a story like that.
What's it like to be around talents like Van Damme, who are very good at what they do, and Jackie Chan, people like that? Is when they come into a room, does the room just completely change, or just explain how that works?
Well, the husbands grab the wives and hold them a little tighter. I will say, you know, there is a certain presence that some of these people have, men and women, that command a room. Not just because they're famous. Some people just have an aura, an energy. And that's what I think the film industry is attracted to. You know, might not be the best looking person in the world, but they have this something about them when they walk in a room, just commands a room. So I think, yeah, there is a bit of both of that. Certain actors don't want to be recognized. You know, they just want a little bit of anonymity if they can get it. Some people, you know, love the limelight. So Stallone was always a great guy, very easygoing, smart. I mean, brilliant guy. Man of few words around people, but he's a great writer, always writing. You know, just they're just normal people like all of us. You know, I've met Kevin Spacey is a client of ours, great guy. Will Smith is a client of ours. I'm trying to put an event together right now with Michael Bay, who's one of the biggest directors in Hollywood, who leads a very private life. You know, all these people try to keep to themselves and where they can. As a matter of fact, we have an event coming up, Art Basel, which is the biggest art event in the world by far. Is coming up on December the 5th is the opening, 5th to the 10th. And that is a celebrity hangout. I mean, that's where it's fun to kind of people watch and see actors, athletes, musicians walk around and collect art. You know, it's art is that one thing that really kind of allows you to peer into people's souls a little bit. You know, they tend to expose themselves in art. I mean, not physically, literally, but their emotions. So I always find it interesting to see what actors buy, what art moves them that they want to put in their house that gives them that, you know, sense of home.
I read a book by the attorney that worked for Johnny Carson for years. It was an interesting book. Not so much, I mean, there were some things about him. What I found really interesting is Carson dragged him along everywhere so he would have an excuse to leave a party if he didn't want to stay. Like the attorney says, you have an appointment somewhere else, so he could, you know, gracefully leave something, and there was always a signal there. But one thing this man noticed as an attorney, meeting all these different people in show business, is he in general, some exceptions, actors he thought were pretty boring people because they were just reciting lines other people had written. Other people like Stallone are writers, a few actors are, but I thought that was an interesting observation. What does that dovetail anything you found, or do you find that the actors are creative people themselves?
You know, it's everybody's different. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certain people. I mean, you look at through time, people like Robin Williams, Jim Carrey, as an example, Jerry Lewis. These are all people that people expected them to be on. When they saw them in person, they were expecting to see that person on television. Adam Sandler is a very good friend of mine. I've known him for 30 years. He's a very quiet, reserved guy, but you know, they get around other people and people expect them to be a certain way, so they kind of cater to it sometimes.
David Letterman, I never knew him well. We knew each other a little bit, and I had a radio show one night before he became famous. He was writing for another comic out in LA, and he was on this radio show, and before we went on, we were just talking about people that we know, and they were a very regular conversation like I'd have with them. Then once we went on the air, you know, it's like that switch flipped, and he became that public person.
Because that's what they expect. That's what they want.
He had a private side, too. He didn't really want to be bothered all the time when he was by himself. And I find that interesting because I found a lot of people who get fame, they want fame, and they get the fame is like, oh, this is what goes with fame. And they retrench and want to be very private. And I can certainly understand that.
You're kind of selling your soul, you know? I mean, that's why you have, you know, Robin Williams killed himself, you know, and everybody's like, how could this man, you know, this guy who always seems so happy, so brilliant, so because they're also very tormented. You know, they have this kind of the side that they would love to show, but that people don't want to see that side.
Yeah, that's the public act. People don't realize you're acting.
Right.
You're not really being yourself. Right. Yourself is somebody else. When you're acting and you're on a stage or you're in front of a camera or a microphone to some extent, you're being the person that the director wants you to be or someone else wants you to be or the writer wants you to be. You're not being yourself, are you?
Now, there are certain actors, I will say, that are very much the character that they are And unfortunately, that also you tend to see the roles they play. It's just that guy. That guy. You know, he's just being that guy, you know, just spewing out different dialogue, but they're that same person that they are in each movie. They're just that caricature. And that's who they are in real life too. And sometimes you go, "Wow, they're such a great actor." And, well, no, he's just being himself, you know. You know, and there are a few like that. I think that Hollywood has gone through a big change since the advent of reality television, where anybody can be an actor, anybody can be on film. Anybody can be famous just for the sake of being famous, not for actually doing anything. You know, Kardashian's example. You know, there weren't any talented people that were like discovered. And like, no, they just, you know, did some sex videos. And next thing, you know,
I asked my 20-something daughter. I said, "Why do you watch the Kardashians?
Why do you look at a car crash when you're driving by on the freeway?"
That's about the answer I got, because they're just really interesting people because they're so different and strange. It sucked me in, and I have to watch it. I mean, I can't watch that.
Well, it's
stuff.
Very voyeuristic.
You well, that's know, we one think way to put it.
Yeah. We think we're watching something that's you know, oh, something might crazy might happen. You know,
sometimes it does.
Sometimes it does, but sometimes it's also just, you know, it's encouraged. It's not true. It's not real. It's not spontaneous. Whether they want to accept it or not, there's a camera somewhere. So everybody is on in some way. You know, you can't help that. So, but yes, but since reality television Hollywood has completely changed, it's become, it's very hard for young people that are talented. Now hold on, I'm going to contradict myself. There is a lot more production out there. Every you know, network now, every cable network is producing their own shows.
And then there's Netflix to the streaming
services. Yeah, they're all producing. Mm-hmm. So there's a massive amount of production going on worldwide. But it's still a very, it's a cutthroat business. And, you know, I meet people all the time and say, "Oh, I want to go out to L.A. and be an actor." And then they go, "Okay, you have fun with that, because you hope you're ready to sacrifice." Because, you know, I've also met over the years some phenomenally great actors that are still waiting tables and bartending.
Sure.
Just never got their shot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's tough. It's tough. You have to have a thick skin.
Oh, yes.
You know?
So who's the best kind of stuntman or action star nowadays? I've heard a lot of people say that, especially after the John Wick movies, that Keanu Reeves is really at the top currently, someone that age, because he does do his own stunts still. And
he does about 75% of them, yeah.
But a lot of people don't do their own stunts anymore. They used to do them.
Well, there's two sides to that. There's also a lot of them never got to do their stunts before. And now, because of the technology and mm-hmm. the safety that we have now, they're able to, you know, the insurance companies.
I was
are
about
like,
to mention the insurance
yeah,
companies.
The
part
insurance,
of that, yeah.
insurance companies is an example. When Tom Cruise was doing a film in Dubai, and they wanted a scene of him hanging out this window of the skyscraper.
Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not that, apparently you know all the movies. I forgot my company I'm in. Okay. Yes, that one. Yeah. So they're hanging him out, and they have the stunt guy out there, and the stunt guy's doing the thing, and Tom's like, "Well, I want to go out there. I can do it." And the insurance company is like, "I don't really think that's really a great idea." But the production company went to the stunt coordinator, and the stunt coordinator's like, "Nothing's going to happen to him. He might crap his pants, but outside of that, nothing's going to happen to him." So they said, "Okay, screw it. If he's completely safe and there's no risk, strap him up, throw him out the window." So they did it. Now, he was not out there very long, but, you know, they needed to get, they were willing to get the shot with him out there and put him out there at risk, but really not a lot of risk.
But it was
just a question if he's willing to go out there.
And that made that movie, I mean, that's a memorable action scene. Yeah, the one where they're going up the the tower in Dubai. I feel like it really does make a difference. If, even for a few shots, some of the actors can do their own stunts. Because
it
you remember watching For example, when I grew up, I used to like to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And
I worked on the movie, the Buffy.
Oh, yeah, with Joss Whedon. Well, it was always, as much as I liked the show, it was always distracting that as soon as there was a fight scene on, the body type completely changed, and there was always the wigs on. And there's a even, you know, the vampire or whatever, yeah. It was like, wait a second, that's not even a woman anymore. That's
like, yeah, it's a small Asian boy.
Yeah. They just put a wig on someone. But if you can at least see a few shots of the actors, I think it does make a huge difference. So.
It does. I mean, it does help seal the, you know, it gives that sense of reality. So, yeah, I mean, somebody like Keanu, he's trained for many, many, many years. In the first one, a good friend of mine, Daniel Bernhardt, was in that and plays one of the main fighters in that. And Daniel trained with Grandmaster Heel Cho out of L.A., in Santa Monica. And Heel Cho is one of the best grandmasters in America and also worked with Keanu for many, many, many years. So I know they've put Keanu through a lot of training. And Daniel tends to go with him to do a lot of the things now. You know, you get that guy that you feel comfortable with that can make you feel fluid in all the action sequences, and it's not, you know, it's not stop, start, stop, start. And the director is everything. You know, directing fight scenes is not as easy as people think. You know, angles, selling the shots, and actors do get hurt. Stallone has, he's had his ribs cracked. He's got horrible neck problems now from, you know, when you sell shots, you're throwing yourself around like a rag doll. And when you're even an actor doing action movies, even if you're not throwing yourself out of a building, but you're doing all these fight scenes, you take a lot of physical abuse.
I think people don't always understand how much stunt work is also choreography, and that's what describing.
Yeah, I mean, we'll start working on choreography before cameras start rolling on a production. We'll work for 3 or 4 months before, just, you know, laying out all the fights, everything storyboarded. It's on the day of. You know, time is money. And on these big productions, you've got to get two set, ready to go. You know, if you look at a movie like John Wick, you'll see most of the action stuff is shot at night. Because nighttime, just you can hide a lot of stuff in the background. Color looks great reflecting off streets. You wet streets down. Just, you know, you can do a lot of tricks with lighting. These guys, you know, you try to hide certain things, but when you're throwing an actor down on a concrete slab, it hurts.
Yes.
You know, and Keanu took some horrible shots. I mean, he really put himself through a battle on this film, and choreographing these things is just a piece of it. You know, to put a fight scene together, what you're looking on film takes months of prepping beforehand and then shooting. You know, and there's cables, which all get taken out later. You know, a lot of those use some cables. And that's also something that really has become, really in the past 10 years, there was a movie that the Chinese produced called Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah. Great film.
That started the whole trend in going for Western movies to start using cable effects. And because they were like, these guys are floating in the air. How do they do that? The actors look so amazing. We got to do that. So then John Woo came over and said, well, we'll just incorporate that into some American productions. So now everything you see, you know, from the Avengers movies, I mean, everything is cables now. Because these guys are doing multiple flips and crazy shit in the air. Or, you know, you're going, the body just doesn't do that. I don't care how athletic you are. So now these actors are being, you know, put in these harnesses and thrown around on these blue screens, trying to act to nothing's there, which is 75% of the action you're seeing now is all blue screen and, you know, special effects. And all that started because of 300.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
how hard is it for the actors when you're not really playing off people on a soundstage? You're actually imagining you have these things around you, which are physically not there.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, they use these little sticks with tennis balls on the end for eye lines.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. You know, the full arm there. Here's your eye line. There he is. You know, you're like, there he goes. You know, chasing this stupid tennis ball around. You know. but then, like, what they'll try to do is before you're doing the scene, they'll, you know, they've shown you the storyboard of the film. So you're, you know, saying, okay, right behind you, there's that lovely mountain range and this big, you know, the three moons. And you're looking, you're going, okay. You know, you're kind of looking up at the studio wall. But you're looking at this photograph, and you're kind of picturing yourself in it, and then you go and act to it, you know, and hope that everything works in cue.
So I'll end with this. So I was reading an interesting article about a film, if anyone remembers this, the Street Fighter movie back in the day with Van Damme, where it was kind of this classic production where everything seemed to kind of go wrong. You know, the actors were getting STDs out in Thailand, and you know, they didn't have one of the characters cast all the way through, and people were getting injured. But the lesson that you kind of get from that is, no matter what happens, the show must go on. They got to finish the movie in a lot of these cases. Have you ever been on a production where everything seems to go wrong, but you powered through? And I want to hear that story.
I think really the question is, have I not been on a film? because I would say almost every film, you're thinking, how the hell is this going to look when we're done? And, you know, they pull it together. You know, because when you're getting a script and you're working on the movie, you're not working in sequence. Mm-hmm. They're bouncing from page to page, to the front, to the back, to the this, to the that. And, you know, you're, again, as an actor, you're like, okay, remember, this is the end of the movie, not the beginning, even though we've been shooting for only 2 days. So you're like, okay, you put yourself into that place. But, yeah, I mean, there's always things that go wrong. I mean, but that's part, in a way, it's just, you just know it. And, you know, going in, and if there aren't challenges, you go, something's wrong. It went way too well. And usually at the end, you realize it should have been more fucked up than it was. You know what I mean? But it wasn't. So when you're just happy to get by it and you wait for that check to come and you're like, well, if they paid me, it must be okay.
One last thing. I want to give you a chance to talk about your art gallery because talk about how you transition from one art form film to another that you are involved with now. Tell us about your art gallery.
Well, quite honestly, I fell into that. I've been my whole life has been basically a series of fortunate accidents. You know, again, falling into the movie business was not something I really. The art business was something my brothers were in that they started through college. And you know, when you see something in your life and your family, and you go, God, I'll never do that, right? Well, here I am. Never say never. So while I was away working on movies, I'd be, you know, on location. I was in Russia for 6 months. I was spent years in China. My brothers would say, hey, you know, find us some really cool artists. You know, you have this great artist over in, you know, in whatever city I was in. So I had a lot of time off. You know, you'd work for a few days, you'd have a few days off, or, you know. So I would, you know, grab a couple of the other people on production and say, let's go find the artist studios. Let's go find the fun stuff to do in town. So I'd always find these artists and I'd, you know, put them in contact with my brothers and, you know. And then one time I had this really bad accident and I couldn't work for a while. And I'm like, what the hell am I going to do with myself? And my ex-wife says to me, she goes, you know, you should open up a damn art gallery. You give your brothers all this art. They're always, you know, doing their thing and maybe you should try it. So I opened a gallery with, you know, and I thought it would be a nice kind of segue into something else. And I realized that artists and actors are the same damn people. They're just as tormented, just as dysfunctional as we all are. So I fit in very well. And so I realized it was my second calling. Since I'm getting too old to jump off of buildings, I can sell a piece of art. And so dealing with artists and creative people, it kind of gives me the ability to stay in that mindset. I've never really been in a corporate world. I don't know how I would survive. So,
but you're obviously a successful businessman now. That's the important thing.
Oh boy, there's a.
I shouldn't say. I'm not supposed to say that.
I would say no. You know, I'm very blessed.
Good.
You know, I'm very blessed. I've got two great kids. I love the town I live in. We got great people here. Carmel has made me, it's given me a home that I really never had. You know, as a kid, I never lived in one place more than 6 months at a time most of my life.
I was trying to figure out your accent. It all got explained to me once you told me where you lived and all throughout Europe. That's a combination of European accents.
I grew up speaking Italian, really almost as my second language. It was the first place we moved when I was a kid. And then I speak German and French and Italian and Spanish, and so it's kind of a bastardization of everything.
I would put a different spin on that. You are you're a well-educated man speaking a number of languages, Evan. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much. Anyone listening, check out the gallery. There's always some really fun stuff going on in there, and if you come in and look at some art, maybe Evan will tell you a story about his days if you just ask him. So
and Donatello's is right across the street.
Yeah, so you can double up. You can go get some food after.
And I eat here every day.
Thank you, Evan. This week, Adam and I were not overly impressed with Kenneth Branagh's latest film, Murder on the Orient Express. Adam and I both gave it a C grade. It's not a bad film. We just don't think this film is as good as many other movies we have seen this year. Hamilton County Goes to the Movies is recorded each week at Donatello's Italian Restaurant in downtown Carmel. If you're a lover of Italian cuisine and have not tried Donatello's, it's time you did. Donatello's is open 11 to 9, Monday through Friday, 5 to 11 Saturdays, closed on Sunday. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again.